At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oh, sure, you coasted through the last week of August and Labor Day thinking everything was okay, that we were done with all those economic jitters. Well, I hate to be the one to break it to you, but welcome back to reality. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. And by Bank of America. Through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America. Bank of Opportunity. Bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today's the 5th of September. It's Wednesday, and it's good to have you with us. It's a bit like a dash of cold water right in the face, isn't it? A couple of weeks ago, the Fed cuts its discount rate. Things mostly settled down, but we learned today it ain't over till it's over. Investors clearly have a ways to go before they'll be feeling better, and it's tough to blame them based on the evidence. First, there's that big backlog of unsold homes the real estate market has to work its way through, something that could take a while since banks and lenders will have to get over their own distrust of loaning out the money first. Also today, a Bush administration official warned that could take a lot more time than anybody thinks. Here's Marketplace's Bob Moon.
As the government sees it, the turmoil in the credit and mortgage markets is far from over. That was the assessment from Treasury Undersecretary Robert Steele in testimony before the House Financial Services Committee. Panel members from both parties gave voice to the nagging worries investors have that there may yet be trouble ahead. New Mexico Republican Steve Pierce likened it to flying a plane through turbulent skies.
Sometimes you get a little tremor and that's it. That's the last you feel of it. Your wing might be about to fall off, but it's the only indication you're going to have.
For now, though, the problem is the fate of the economy is still very much up in the air. The Treasury Undersecretary told the panel policymakers must remain vigilant for what he called further challenges and continued volatility. At the same time, Robert Steele said there's no sign of a recession.
Our view at Treasury is that the economic growth that's been going on in the second quarter will continue with a positive trajectory into the third and fourth quarter, and the economy seems strong.
But money manager Hugh Johnson says the ongoing uncertainty in the credit markets keeps the pressure on Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and his team to lower interest rates at their next meeting in a couple of weeks.
There has to be something that instills confidence that we're going to work through this very difficult period in an orderly fashion. And quite frankly, I think it really depends on what the Federal Reserve does.
Today, though, the Fed's own Beige Book report concludes that even though the housing slump has deepened, there's been little effect so far on the overall economy. That could mean less aggressive interest rate moves than investors want. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
When we heard about the latest Mattel recall, 800,000 imported Chinese toys this time, we sent a producer out to talk to some consumers to get some idea of how they're feeling. What she came back with is Mattel CEO Bob Eckert's worst nightmare.
I'm not going to purchase any made in China products right now because I want to protect my kids.
That's Amy Miller with her two-year-old daughter on her hip outside of Toys R Us up in Glendale, California. She and her husband have a four-year-old as well, and she told us they've already thrown away a box full of toys from Mattel, from Fisher-Price, anything they think might hurt the kids.
We feed them the right foods. We take them to the right schools. We only do organic stuff. So, and here they are playing with educational toys, and they're getting lead poisoning, so I want to avoid that.
Miller said she's bracing for the next recall, and she's already told her relatives, nothing from Mattel for Christmas, please. Toy companies are bracing for a less-than-jolly holiday season, too, as our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barchet reports.
Like falling dominoes, it's been one toy recall after another since June. The Toy Industry Association is getting worried, though it says all the recalls don't add up to even 1% of the 3 billion toys sold each year. Joan Lawrence is vice president.
We are concerned the effect that the recalls might have on the reputation of the industry as a whole.
Mattel is a member of the Toy Industry Association. Today, the association actually called for a federal mandate that toys be tested by their makers. And toy makers are working on a standard procedure for toy testing. Jim Silver is editor of the magazine Toy Wishes. He says this latest recall came from Mattel's desire to rebuild its reputation by retesting its entire inventory.
You can be proactive and go back and check your items and test them thoroughly, or you could be reactive and wait until another issue comes out. Mattel chose to be proactive.
Silver says right now the entire toy industry is testing their products for lead and other hazards. That could crimp just-in-time delivery cycles that manufacturers rely on. It's hard to predict what will be a hit this season, but he says it might not be there when you want it.
Whereas something might be able to hit the shelves in about 2 months might take an extra 2 or 3 weeks because of the extra steps needed to continually test. Now those items might not replenish until after Christmas.
Hopefully they'll be on sale then. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet for Marketplace.
Three big recalls in a couple of months can do some damage to your share price. Mattel squeaked out a penny gain today, but it's down 20% since June. $8.86 for a bushel of wheat might not sound like much, but when you're buying it by the ton, it can add up pretty fast. Wheat prices hit a record high at the Chicago Board of Trade today, ditto for futures contracts in other global markets. The immediate reason is bad weather for wheat growing now in Western Europe, Australia, and parts of the United States. But Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports there are longer-term trends that are going to keep wheat expensive for a while.
Just in the last couple days, India, Egypt, and Iraq, which normally grow their own wheat, have placed big orders for imports. Meanwhile, hot winds in western Australia this week damaged that country's already dry fields. The southern U.S. has suffered from 2 years of drought, and this year there was too much rain in the southern plain states and western Europe. And with the growing use of corn and soybeans for transportation fuel, farmers are shifting cropland away from wheat. Kansas State University's Mark Fowler says the scarcity of wheat is attracting speculators.
Investment funds are entering the grain commodity market as another vehicle to invest into. An influx of cash into the commodity markets is increasing the trading of grain.
The price of some pastas in Italy has risen 50%. German bread is up 20%. Joe Sowers with the Wheat Growers Trade Association says right now the wheat shortage is most acute in Europe.
You'll have to look at some of that happening here in the U.S., but I don't know if you've been to the grocery store. You're just not seeing any price reaction as of yet, despite this literally year, almost going on 2 years of price increases, right?
One reason, Sowers says, the price of wheat is only a fraction of the total cost of bread or cereal. Eventually, he says the high return for growing wheat will pull more farmers away from corn for ethanol. He's predicting a good harvest of winter wheat next spring. In the meantime, brace yourself for some sticker shock in the bread aisle. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Bob Moon set us up to get things going today. Here's the payoff. Down all the way around on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We'll get the official August unemployment report Friday morning from the Department of Labor, but we got a sneak peek today. The ADP National Employment Survey, that's from a private group, says the economy added just 38,000 jobs last month, the worst it's been in more than 4 years. Commentator Robert Reich points out that's not likely to stop consumers from spending, as we are wont to do, but something else might.
Even before Wall Street went bonkers, consumer debt was at an all-time high and median wages were dropping. But most of us didn't have to face these unpleasant facts because loose lending and easy money pushed up the value of our homes. So we could treat our homes like bottomless piggy banks through refinancing and home equity loans and pretend we were rich enough to go on splurging. Now that the days of loose lending and easy money are over, however, home prices are dropping all over the country, and our piggy banks have gone bust. So we have to face the awful truth that, as the Census Bureau revealed last week, the median household is earning less than it did in 2000, before the last recession. Meanwhile, the costs of fuel and health insurance continue to rise. That same census report showed that more middle-class Americans than ever can't even afford health insurance. Add to this an estimated 2 million families who won't be able to meet their mortgage payments over the coming year, millions more who are afraid they won't be able to, a spike in the rate of credit card defaults, and a new law making it harder than ever to declare personal bankruptcy. And what do you get? An American middle class suddenly aware it's been living way beyond its means and can't do it anymore. The only group whose earnings last year were higher than in 2000 are households in the top 5% of the distribution. Even if you have no ethical qualms at all about the widening gap between the rich and everybody else in America, you got to know that the rich can't possibly buy enough to keep the economy going. For that, we need a huge middle class with money in their pockets. And that's exactly the problem. Wall Street's crisis is shocking the middle class into realizing how little money it actually has. And that realization may push us smack into a recession.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Once upon a time, he was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. Bob's got a new book out, Super Capitalism, it's called. We'll have him on next week to talk about it. In the meanwhile, send us your comments. Our website is marketplace.org. Looking for an apartment's never easy, but here's a hint if you promise not to tell anybody else. The Vatican's got some really good deals. Seriously. Even beyond St. Peter's, the Catholic Church owns a lot of pricey real estate in Rome. For years, many of its tenants paid quite reasonable amounts, and they came to believe they were protected from rising rents. But Megan Williams reports now from Rome their faith was misplaced.
It may be the last summer 65-year-old Franco Lattughi welcomes a guest into his spacious, sunlit apartment in the historic center of Rome.
Buongiorno. Come sta? Si accomodi, prego. Grazie.
Lattughi, a tour guide, remembers 12 years ago when a priest at the Vatican office first told him this apartment was available.
And he called us, he said, we have a flat. It was this flat, and it was very big, and later on, I found out nobody wanted it because it was a wreck of a flat. And the habit is if you restore the flat, you can have a good rent in the center of the city. And they say you can have it the whole of your life, just the increase of the according to the inflation, yes.
Lattughi and his wife spent their life savings of about $150,000 to fix up the rental unit. They signed an 8-year lease, but, says Lattughi, with a verbal promise from the Vatican that the apartment was theirs for good, a standard practice at the time. The rent of almost $1,000 a month was pegged to Latugi's modest income. Then recently, Lattughi and a host of other Vatican apartment renters got the shock of their lives. A notice from the Vatican to start paying market rate, about $3,000 a month, or get out.
I say, well, if I knew that you are going to put up the price after 8 years, I wouldn't have taken it because I took it for these conditions.
Lattughi says the Vatican has a moral obligation to repay his investment if he leaves, something the Vatican so far has refused to do, he says. Michele Anese is a Roman architect and real estate agent.
The Vatican basically owns all the best apartments in Rome, in the historical part.
He says real estate prices and rents have doubled in Rome since 2000, and that the Vatican is really just catching up with the times.
For a while, it was a very not organized market because it was a kind of the parish took care of the rentals. So now things are completely changed. They have a very efficient, very central office.
The Vatican didn't respond to a request for an interview, but Anese says it's understandable that it wants to get the most out of its rents, which go to fund missionary work abroad. He says a big culprit in rising prices isn't the Vatican, but the hundreds of apartments people leave empty until their kids are old enough to move in.
I think that's a typical Roman attitude that is not in the rest of the world, because if you buy a property, you put on the market, you want some incomes from that. Instead, in Rome, they don't care. They just leave it like that for 10 years.
For renters like Franco Latughi, who thought they'd found a safe haven with the Vatican, there's little consolation.
I'm a victim of the shift of the system, you see. Before they were maybe too tolerant, and now they are going to turn the screw, and I'm cut in the middle.
And like so many other renters in Rome who haven't been blessed with Vatican apartments, he's now feeling the squeeze. In Rome, I'm Megan Williams for Marketplace.
Coming up, economics, ethnicity, and a college education.
Why, of all the millions of other things that might have contributed to an admissions decision, are people quick to fasten on affirmative action?
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets got caught in that wind shear from the housing market today with no lift at all from the Federal Reserve. The Dow Industrials lopped off 143 points, 1%, to end at 13,305. The Nasdaq parted with 24 points, nearly 1%, to finish at 2605. The S&P 500 yielded 17 points, 1.1%, to close at 1472. Homebuilders took a hammering from that dramatic drop in pending July home sales. KB Home knocked off 5%. Beazer Home scraped off 4%. Toll Brothers and Lennar each sanded away about 3%. Investment banks had a rocky day today. Investors are fretting about what the subprime mess will do to their earnings, and in the case of Citigroup, about that bank's exposure to potential losses from billions in commercial paper. Citigroup and J.P. Morgan both dropped 2.5% today. Tyson Foods plunged 13%. The biggest processor of U.S. meat cut its full-year earnings forecast. Cattle and hog costs apparently rose more than expected. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Duke University's Fuqua School of Business Executive MBA programs, where working professionals earn Duke MBAs from locations around the world. Online at DukeExecutiveMBA.com. And by the American Public Transportation Association, supporting America's public transportation systems, working to help reduce greenhouse gases for a better environment at publictransportation.org. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In New York, the nation's largest retailers report sales figures for August. In Washington, the House Armed Services Committee meets to discuss what's next for Iraq. And the great picture goes on display in Pasadena. Great as in really, really big. The photograph is billed as the world's largest, measuring 3 stories high and 11 stories wide. I'm sure that was an interesting development process. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We do business here mostly, as you know, not politics, but sometimes the line that divides those two is pretty thin. Back in the 1996 presidential campaign, a Clinton pollster named Mark Penn highlighted what he thought was an important Democratic constituency, soccer moms, one key to the Clinton win that year. With another election looming, Mark Penn is out with his first book along sort of the same lines. It's called Microtrends. Mr. Penn, good to have you here.
Thank you.
Why microtrends and not the really big mega ones that are going to change the planet?
Well, I think that the point is that the microtrends are becoming the megatrends of tomorrow. That things no longer have to become big to be important, that a small trend can have a very influential impact on what happens in society, and that increasingly people are going their own ways in many different directions, but bonded together by common choices they're making.
How small, though, is big enough to make a difference, if you take my meaning?
Well, 1% of the population today that does anything, that buys this book, that goes to see a movie, that creates a movement or a church. In the book, we said, God forbid, suppose 1% became terrorists. Society as we know it would be over.
Just to quantify here, 1% of the American population is about 3 million people, so it's not really small at all, is it?
Well, that's right. We're such a big society that 1% is 3 million, and that 3 million can have a huge impact on the outcome. You know, in the last presidential election, for example, that would have turned the difference.
Let's get down to brass tacks here. I mean, somebody listening to you and me talk, what are they going to take away from this book? How can they apply it in their small business or in their stock portfolio?
Well, I think that they're going to look for new marketplaces. You know, let's take a look at something like middle-class second home buyers. Well, I think as interest rates went down, real estate speculation and interest went up, 5 million people who were in the middle class bought second homes. They needed gardeners. They needed bill-paying services. They needed all sorts of new stuff. I think if you tap into the desire for people to make things, maybe you'll come up with other things that, you know, use people's hands. Maybe, you know, you'll come up with interesting new activities for people who want to continue to work past the normal retirement age.
You're a numbers guy, so I'm sure you've had at some point in your life somebody say to you, numbers, lies, damn lies, and statistics. I mean, you can read too much into numbers, can't you?
I think that people could interpret numbers and statistics in many different ways. Part of what I do is hopefully, you know, have a higher degree of accuracy in predicting what's important, what's not important, things that we should follow. But I think that the bigger danger is not really opening yourself up to a country of well over 300 million people changing in so many different ways, opening up so many new, unexpected marketplaces. Part of what we try to teach people is how to see the counterintuitive of what everybody is talking about. It's counterintuitive that teenagers today are flocking to knitting. Everybody knows they're flocking to cell phones. But at the same time, I think there's a desire by people, hey, I want to make something. And so the entrepreneur who can fill that marketplace that's opened up by the dominant trend to technology then looks for the counter trend or the micro trend to try to fill that in a way that's significant and meaningful.
Are they really flocking to knitting?
Yeah, there's been a huge growth in knitting.
See, now there you go. There's a micro trend that I never would have known about.
Look, I think people will find some they know, some they don't know, some they think they know, some they're glad to find out. A lot of people eventually find themselves in the book.
The book by Mark Penn is called Micro Trends. He's the CEO of the PR firm Burson Marsteller. He's also the chief advisor and pollster for the presidential campaign of Senator Hillary Clinton. Mr. Penn, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you very much.
We're spending some time this week as classes get going, taking a look at education, K through 12 and beyond. Yesterday, it was the rising cost of college, how students are turning to different kinds of schools to get more for their money. Today, affirmative action, race-based and otherwise. From North Carolina Public Radio, Dave DeWitt reports some supporters of traditional affirmative action now see a different way of creating diverse student bodies.
Steve Farmer knows every freshman at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Maybe not personally or even by name, but he knows their academic credentials. As director of admissions, he and his staff carefully review every file from every potential student.
We pay attention to test scores. We pay attention to GPAs. We pay attention to ranks in class. We pay attention to grades.
UNC accepts about 7,000 applicants, and a little more than half enroll. Like most schools, UNC considers race in filling those slots. Sometimes parents call Steve Farmer and they focus on that one checked box tucked deep inside that large file as the reason their child didn't make the cut.
Why, of all the millions of other things that might have contributed to an admissions decision, are people quick to fasten on affirmative action or race-conscious admissions, or again, that African-American child down the street as the reason why a child didn't get in?
Race-conscious admissions is, of course, legal, but it's not very popular. In a recent poll, Americans disagreed with race-based affirmative action 2-1, but overwhelmingly supported giving those same preferences to low-income students. Richard Kallenberg believes in that. He's a senior fellow at the Century Foundation.
To my mind, if your admissions decision comes down to the question of admitting an African American who is the son of a doctor or a white student whose mother is a waitress, I think fairness dictates that we give an edge to the more disadvantaged student.
It can be hard for people to separate socioeconomic class from race. Michael Wilson just graduated with honors from North Carolina State. She's the daughter of two professionals.
I'll be honest, it's kind of hard for me to meet a white person or really truly recognize that there are white students here who aren't driving those brand new cars and everything like that. And that's something that I think society has made me feel, okay, white, rich, black, poor.
The truth is, low-income whites outnumber low-income African Americans. So a system based solely on income would seem to favor poor whites. Charles Day is a law professor at UNC. He says one group that would be harmed is low-income African Americans who are accepted.
What you might do is take a lower-income black kid in preference to a higher-income black kid, because you can't take race into account. So you get the student in your school who is actually less well-equipped to survive and to prosper.
One of Day's classes is housing law. Only a few are students of color. It's not obvious who comes from low-income backgrounds, but those in the class know. Sven Diehl is in his third year. He says classmates pick up on each other's experiences pretty quickly and learn from each other.
I had an interview at a law firm, and they asked me, we have a diverse set of clients. We don't have just people that can, you know, pay a lot of money. What skills do you have in that regard that are going to help you to relate with those clients? And I had an easy answer, because that has been my educational experience throughout elementary school all the way through now.
The Supreme Court ruled in June that schools, grades K through 12, can no longer allocate students based on race. The public school system in Wake County, North Carolina, is ahead of the curve. 7 years ago, the school system that serves Raleigh and its suburbs adopted a diversity plan based on income. Colleges and universities are keeping an eye on that approach, as many observers believe affirmative action in higher education will be outlawed soon. Richard Kallenberg compares programs like Wake County's to our progressive income tax system, in which we tax the wealthy at a higher rate than those who earn less. Kallenberg says this is fair and legally justifiable.
If, by contrast, we had a system in which different races were taxed at different levels, if whites were taxed at a higher marginal rate than Latinos or African Americans, there'd be a huge legal problem with that approach.
Wake County put the program in place in 2000, and since then, students at every income level have improved academically. The school system is growing explosively, but the district has maintained economic and racial diversity in many schools. This fall, up to 30 U.S. school districts will consider similar models. In Chapel Hill, I'm Dave DeWitt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, yet another boffo day for Apple CEO Steve Jobs. His latest gizmo announced today is called the iPod Touch. It uses the same touch technology as the iPhone, minus the phone part, of course. There were some other bells and whistles that everybody's talking about, but here's the big news. Apple's cutting the sticker price of the iPhone $200. You might remember it went on sale for almost $600 just a couple of months ago. So much for being the first kid on the block to have one, I guess. Early adopters were not pleased. Apple shares fell more than 5% today. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Welcome back indeed. Today, the Dow fell 143 points, 1%. The NASDAQ dropped 24 points, nearly 1%. The S&P 500 shook off 14 points. That is 1.1%. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on this program, this fall's financial forecast, gloom, doom.
I think probably we've passed through the eye of the storm and we've got a lot more to come. And I don't think any of it is going to be very good.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.